As I was walking out of the library to come here, Shiva told me to pick up this book and bring it along. So I decided maybe I should read something from it. it's a book of poetry by Hakim Sanayi, who is the predecessor of Rumi and Attar and pretty much all of the famous Sufi poets of that golden age that we have been reading. He was one of the first, and this book is translated as The Walled Garden of Truth. And it's got some very interesting poems in it. It's an abridged version, but it packs a punch. I'll read an extract of just the first poem, which is entitled The Garden of Reality. The seeing soul perceives the folly of praising anyone other than the Creator. Okay, so I think this is an important statement. No one but the Creator is worthy of praise. And yet, isn't the Creator working through everyone? The self is a servant in his cavalcade. Reason, a new boy in his school. What is reason in this guest house but a crooked scrawling of God's handwriting? So, although it seems to be an attack on reason, it's actually saying that what the ego takes for reason is a distorted version of the reason that flows through the mind of God. The human level of reason is actually idiocy. It's a primitive form of calculation that it doesn't even deserve the name of logic, because it is trapped in a two-valued paradigm which allows for no wider spectrum of possibilities than yes or no, black or white. And this kind of primitive thinking is exactly what creates karma, because it is not in sync with the attunement to the panorama of all of the potentialities of being and becoming that do not fit into either good or bad, right or wrong, yes or no. So what we require is a form of wisdom that is the real reason, that is beyond what humans refer to as that which is really only mental chatter. It's not true reasoning. The human ego is not capable until the fourth and fifth assemblage point of beginning to know what reason really is, and to be able to read the mind of God and translate that into language and action. So, had he not shown himself, meaning God, Allah, how should we have known him? Unless he shows us the way, how can we know him? But how did he show himself? You know, the Christians would say, well, he showed himself in the form of Jesus. How did he show himself to the Muslims? Was it through the writing of the Quran? Was it through the poetry of that inspired text? Or was there an inherent knowing of God within that one can attune to in prayer, in adoration of Allah, which triggers a remembrance of one's relationship to God before birth, before one ever left the kingdom of the light to incarnate? And is he not still always showing us the way if we are willing to attend to the messages of the Tao that are presented. We tried reasoning our way to him. It didn't work. But the moment we gave up, no obstacle remained. So, in other words, not through language, which presents a very primitive form of reason in the form of subject and predicate, a linear kind of presentation of reality that forms itself into a frame of reference of succession, therefore of time and space and of duality of subject and object, but of an intuitive knowing that that is present as soon as there is a giving up, a surrender of the ego's attempt to grasp reality through its own modes of thinking rather than to attune to the mode of God's presence and intelligence that is constantly directing manifesting all that appears. So he introduced himself to us out of kindness. How else could we have known him? Reason took us as far as the door, but it was his presence that let us in. So you can think about God, or you can feel God's presence in your consciousness, because God is present here and now as yourself, but yourself that is not the thinking, language-based stream of egoic mental chatter, but the self that is the pure presence that underlies it all. But how will you ever know him as long as you are unable to know yourself, since God is yourself? Once one is one, no more, no less, error begins with duality. Unity knows no error. Okay, so true reason begins when you understand you are in a condition of non-duality. Until then, reason cannot begin to function, because the mind is based in illusion and therefore cannot see it, one's own errors. The error of perception that because it is limited in time and space can only know oneself in the future, and only then will one be able to answer the question, who was I? But one will still not know the answer to who am I? You see? And so most people are constantly trying to figure out, why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why did I go there? Why? And trying to figure out what was the basis of their identity that brought them to make such choices and fall into such patterns and such tenacious identification and attachment to a particular way of thinking. So it's only when one has attained non-duality that the errors of false reasoning fall away. He continues, place itself has no place. How could there be place for the creator of place? Heaven for the maker of heaven. Okay, in other words, God is not located in space or time. God is omnipresent, and in all times one can connect with God, but only because God is beyond time in eternity and without place, which is why you can connect with God everywhere and nowhere, and whether the body is alive or dead. And so to limit your consciousness to a frame of reference based in space and time limits your ability to understand the true nature of who you are that transcends that limited linear arc of becoming that is the fate of the ego. He said, Allah said, and this is a famous quote, I think it is from the Quran, I was a hidden treasure. Creation was created so that you might know me. But isn't it really so that I might know myself, since all that is created is in fact still a reflection of God himself, but a reflection that is not able to know its own original image. Okay, in the Kashmir Shaivite wisdom school, they refer to this concept as well as the Bimba Pratibimba concept or principle. And Bimba is means God's image, and Pratibimba is the reflection of that image. So the image is the archetypal form that is, for the Greeks, the nous, the mind of God that is reflected as a cosmos. The world is simply the reflection of the archetypal image being transmitted, and transmitted in a slightly different way through each facet of the infinite diamond mind that God is, and each of us being one or more of those facets that is able to see the world through a particular archetypal idiom. So he goes on, why, tell me, if what you seek does not exist in any place, do you propose to travel there on foot? He's talking about, why are you taking a pilgrimage to the Hajj, to Mecca, when God is right here, wherever you are? I don't know if you all saw the great storm in Mecca the other day. It was being destroyed. The whole Kaaba was in chaos. It was an extraordinary scene. You might want to check it out. One of the few reasons it's good to have an internet, I think. But it gives us the images of the end times that we are in. So he says, the road yourself must journey on lies in polishing the mirror of your heart. Where have we heard that before? Right? And yet at the same time, you know, if we remember the fifth or the sixth patriarch of Chan Buddhism, he won his title not by, but by actually refuting that and saying, no, there's no need, there's nothing to polish. No dust could ever settle on it. There's only God consciousness. And it's important not to believe in the dust and the stains that you believe are causing your heart not to be able to hold an accurate pratibimba or reflection of the image of God. You're able to, but because the mind is filling itself with other images that are attractive to lower chakra vibrational frequencies of our consciousness, we do not gain an accurate reflection of the image. And he goes on to delve into why that is, and he says, it is not by rebellion and discord that the heart's mirror is polished free of the rust of hypocrisy and unbelief. Your mirror is polished by your certitude, by the unalloyed purity of your faith. So here we have something that I think is the point of the greatest obstacle for the postmodern ego, which cannot have faith or certitude in part because it has learned that the nature of reality, according to quantum physics, is indeterminacy, not certitude, and that we cannot be certain of anything at the ego level. Everything we think, in fact, is wrong, and we cannot prove anything to be real. And what is real cannot be proved even to be at all, because it is not an appearance, not a reflection. And so there's a way in which we must surrender the certitude of the ego to attain the certitude of presence. That's the result of faith, the willingness to let go of certitude at the level of mathematics, language, physics, whatever kind of objective fiction we want to believe in, and find the certitude of presence itself, which cannot be denied. One cannot deny I am. One can deny I am this or that, or what I will be, but I cannot deny the am-ness, the beingness of presence. So he goes on, if you want the mirror to reflect the face, hold it straight and keep it polished bright. Although the sun does not begrudge its light, when seen in a mist, it only looks like glass, and creatures comelier than angels even seem in a dagger to have devil's faces. In those days, people carried polished daggers that could be used as mirrors, right? But of course, the dagger is also used for violence and the aggressivity of the ego. And that creates a mist around our ability to see, a mist of paranoia and a mist of all of the identificatory attachments that pertain to the fear of depersonalization and non-existence as an ego. So, the mirror must be held straight, and that means our consciousness must be straight, not crooked. It must see things and face reality straight, without buffers, without wanting a mist of denial and repression, of unbearable knowledge, of skeletons in the ego's closet, and of unexamined aspects of the ego's lack of being and of open-heartedness and of clarity of reason. He goes on, your dagger will never tell you true from false. It will never serve you as a mirror. Better to seek your image in your heart than in your mortal clay. Break free from the chains you have forged about yourself, for you will be free when you are free of clay. The body is dark. The heart is shining bright. The body is mere compost. The heart, a blooming garden. So, we want to be free of identifying with the compost. It has value, compost, but it's the flowers that come out of it once we have recognized the purpose of that compost and all of its sufferings, all of its anguish, all of its lack of certitude, all of its false reasoning, all of the karmic accumulations that occur in the ground soil of our lives through the accumulation of experience, all of that has to be turned into wisdom, and into the power of growing beyond the level of Maya, like the lotus in the mucky pond that's untouched by the mud, that grows just a little bit above the level of the waterline. And we must live above the waterline of the illusion created by body consciousness if we are to receive the light of the sun of knowledge. And it's that openness to shining, to the blossoming, to the opening of the heart that transcends both the reason and the identification with clay, with body, with time and space, and with the limitations of the capacity of the ego mind to think. That which is regained through the pure presence attuned to the intelligence of God, that is what liberates us from the prison of the ego. So I won't read any more. There's a lot more to just that one poem and to others in the book. Perhaps I'll return to it and read others at another time. But I thought that might be a good introduction to our situation here at the end of Kali Yuga, in which we have to rapidly transcend all of those karmic thorns and loops that we are still stuck in, and release the Velcro of our attachment to an obsolete identity. So I hope that poetry like this, which is, of course, the use of higher reason in the service of truth and beauty, is a helpful agency of inspiration and of transformation if one reads it with the appropriate seriousness of purpose that comes from this being's obvious learning through his own imperience of struggling to free himself from the egoic shell. And so all of us are at least fledgling poets of spiritual freedom who in our own liberative journey will, as a byproduct, be able to produce art in the form of poetry, music, painting, drama, all of the forms of human culture which come out of this rising above the barbaric level of body consciousness. And here at the end of time, we are living at an extraordinary moment in which culture as such has already died, and we are living in a barbaric time. There is no longer anything but a shadow of the old high culture of the world. And everything is now in a state of dysregulation and self-parody and of perverse deconstructive imitation that denies the nobility and the divine meaning and mission of human consciousness as the steward of the creation. And it is in this moment when one culture has died that a new culture can be born in the vacuum that has been created if we have the courage to enter into that unknown level of our being from which all culture is downloaded and bring about a new epoch of human history. In fact, not even human history. You know, the current academics refer to this time period as the Anthropocene. How many of you have heard that term? You know, it's they mean it as the time when a human consciousness much more than nature, quote unquote, is governing the condition of the ecosystems of the planet. And now it's human industrialization and warfare and all of the kinds of human disfigurement and ravaging of nature and of the forests and the oceans, with all the pollution, the radiation, and the absolute transforming of natural beauty into capital resources, into profit, and all of that which sustains life is being deliberately destroyed in the intention of immediate financial gain. What could be more stupid and more a proof that culture is dead and that we no longer deserve the title of Homo sapiens, because that sapiential capacity has been lost, and the proof is our having allowed this. But we are at the end of the Anthropocene as well. It cannot last. It's unsustainable. But what those who are in that period and who have adapted to the barbarism of this cultureless civilization that is in its demise do not recognize is our own deep history, which is assumed even in this time of quantum physics to be that of some kind of random Darwinian mutational development, and then a subhuman ape man type of gradual evolution from Neanderthal to Cro-Magnon and through all of the primitive levels of what they consider to be a tribal consciousness into the progress of the capitalist system, which is, of course, the most destructive and final phase of our terminal spiritual illness. And they do not recognize the truth that we have come down from a deocene period into a gradual fall into an anthropocene, and that now we are transitioning through a coming angelocene period into a new deocene cycle of time and of new creation. So what they cannot see because of their false paradigm produces a nihilism and a pessimism and a despair rather than the joy of the good news that the return of God consciousness to the world is underway, and that transformation from the death of the old cycle in its omega point to the alpha point of new creation is upon us. And we are present and fortunate to be present at the new creation and to participate in it by recreating ourselves in the image, not the distorted reflection of that image of God consciousness, as the perfect presence of our own being in its real, raw nature that transcends all the mental disguises of the ego's projections of its fantasies, and brings about that amalgamation of energies of nobility that will morph the world back into the purity of our divine image. And so this is the most auspicious and beautiful time to be alive, and to be really alive, not a zombie at that moment of apocalypse when most cannot face the reality that is underway and cannot recognize it as a divine blessing, but can only see the horror, the curse, the ruin, the loss, and not be able to grok the infinite gain that is being offered to all who are open to internal transformation, to be in attunement with that tsunami of vibrational transformation that will change the whole cosmos, to resonate as a receptacle and an agency of God consciousness in all of its infinite forms of life that manifest as a result of its creative intelligence operating through the diamond mind of the infinite self. So, hallelujah. And with that, I will open the floor if anyone has any comments or any questions. Oh, Parvati.
Thank you, Shunya, for coming and for the teaching. I found a lot of the points very impacting. And some that we've been talking about recently, like straightening up and this complete concealment of the ego and inability to reason. And I like the point about the just this needing certitude, but having to go into complete uncertitude. I was most struck, I still get excited. I think every time you make like a reference to something having to do with geology, just because I feel like it's something I can try to pretend I have, feel like I have more understanding of. But at any rate, I was pondering this point you made about entering the Anthropocene, and I feel like when I learned about it, it also had to do with, like, it's a point in time where there's evidence of the human race in the fossil record, and that one of the kind of arguments or points for it was the fact that, like, we, it's like the non-degradable trash, the plastics and that kind of thing, right, being imposing and left behind, and I feel like I was pondering that and feeling like that's what it feels like the ego is made of, just like non-degradable trash, and even like lost the ability to compost. I don't know, but
it's not only not non-degradable, it's already degraded. So no, it has no power to sustain its structure. It's already coming apart and decomposing. So nothing to worry about.
Well, anyway, I gave it a go. That was that.
Was there a question or a comment only about that?
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I guess if that made any sense, kind of understanding it, but apparently not, because we're already degraded.
Well, no, I think what you say is accurate, although there is a dispute among academics as to when the Anthropocene began. You know, was it with the fossil record or with industrialization, which is when all of those non-biodegradable agents got put into the environment. And so I think the consensus nowadays is that it's the modern ego that created the Anthropocene through its creating an unsustainable accumulation of garbage, indeed. And I think that is what the ego has done, which is what we could consider at a mental level as karma. It's simply the garbage that we have not composted. It's degradable, but we haven't done it because of the degradation of the ego that's actually attached to it and doesn't want to bury it or throw it out and have it decompose. It wants to stay, even in a rotten ego with bad karma, rather than to be in the unknowing of a consciousness without identification with a gross bodily icon that gives it an identity that it can see in the mirror. And so, in a way, what Lacan was pointing out with his theory of the mirror stage is that that is when the consciousness gets limited to a body form that is recognized by the mother and eventually the whole family system as this is who you are, and then all of its consciousness that doesn't fit into that identity is cut off, and one remains with only a fractal sliver of one's intelligence and creative potentialities that are now at the service of the need for the approval of the other in order to survive, because the fear of abandonment of the infant is so great that it has to betray itself in order to hold on to a sense of security, and cannot allow itself to grow out of the expectations that will bring the favor of the parents because of its sense that it cannot survive independently. And so it rejects its own sovereignty and becomes the submissive and yet rebellious slave of the parents, but it struggles within that system of identity rather than go on its hero's journey and discover who it is beyond the limitations of whatever paradigm of unreality was forced upon it through the indoctrination of the educational system, and to find a higher meaning in life, as Viktor Frankl was pointing out, as the necessity to be adequate to the challenges of life. And so the very fear of the loss of security is what actually makes us insecure, because we don't have the full repertoire of our abilities present to hand, because they have been cut off, mutilated by our need to be validated by the parents who want us to appear in a certain way. And even though the oppositional ego will rebel against that, it only becomes an attached opposite of or a shadow of itself, rather than attaining the light of the unknown power of consciousness from which it has lost its connection and which is its true nature. So in that sense, the ego will not allow the biodegrading of its identity in order to rediscover its freedom.
So, and then you also said, you talked about the certitude of presence, that it feels like it's always about the unknown of, you know.
No, because once you have attained presence as it is, that itself is the knowledge that was being sought. And one realizes then that the type of knowledge one wanted was based on temporal appearances and a use of consciousness in the service of empirical reason as to what might unfold within the explicate order. But presence transcends that order. It is present to the implicate, present to that which is timeless and that which is spaceless, as he was saying in this poem, and therefore has a kind of supernal knowledge that cannot be known by the ego mind that sees only horizontally and not vertically the full dimensionality of consciousness.
Thank you, Jean.
Okay, thank you.
Hanuman. Thank you, Shinya. I really appreciate the reading of the poem and the framing of it, in that the the reminder or the encouragement that once there is that presence, then the art forms just emerge as a product of that. Mm-hmm. But my question is more in this conversation with Parvati, like it's something I've been thinking a lot about, and the question is really like how to release the defense structure that has formed that keeps one in that enslavement to the family system internally, right? And the rite of passage that it seems like in my mind I can make it into some external journey or something that needs to happen that challenges the mortality of the body. But I feel like you would say it's not, that's externalizing it, right? It's a more of an internal journey that's happening. And I understand that, but I feel like there's a lot of defenses around even going on that journey that's related to that whole process of letting go of the identity. And
what you are expressing is the ego illusion. What you are expressing is the defense. The belief that there are defenses that must be overcome before you can have that rite of passage. See, it's not true. In the same way that if someone passes away, someone dies, they didn't need to be able to create a rainbow body in order to leave and reach the light. They didn't need to transform the body of clay before they could pass into the illumination of incorporeality. That's their original nature. And so there was no obstacle. They didn't have to unlock their cranium in order to get out, right? No process was ever needed because the consciousness was never trapped in the body in the first place. It was already part of the light that is infinite. And it just, the drop realized it was always the ocean. There's no actual shift from one place to another, which is why he again mentions there's no place for the one who is the creator of place, which is consciousness. So you don't need to get rid of or change that defensive structure that is the ego mental apparatus. You just have to realize you're not that. And never were that. Leave it alone. Let it be the same as it was, but you pass out of it. And as soon as you leave it behind and have no longer any interest in it, it biodegrades or spirito degrades into its true nature as simple presence as well, and reflects the image of the archetypal nature of the self in its divine formlessness into the body as well, as long as the body is alive. So you get your mukti, and then that is reflected as a jivan mukti, but you are a videha mukti. Your moksha or mukti itself is the realization you never had anything to do with that body, and whether it's alive or dead is irrelevant to the freedom that is your inherent nature. Okay.
Thank you, Shunya.
Mm-hmm. Tara.
Thank you for the poem. I had a question about when you were talking about the black and white thinking that creates karma. I feel like that's an ongoing mantra in my mind, like I'll often just tell myself, you know, nothing's black and white, nothing's black and white. It's been useful. And in you mentioned that becoming is not black and white, and I just wanted to make sure I understood it correctly, because how I, in my process of using that as almost a mantra, I'll, like situations, people, myself, everything is in a state of becoming, so then not to judge or get fixated on anything, and everything can change, and I see everything changes, and so I wanted to check that was accurate. But then also later on you said that the linear arc of becoming is the fate of the ego. So then I was wondering, are you talking about two different types of becoming? Or I wondered if you could speak about, because it feels like one was in a positive light, that in the state of becoming, nothing is black and white. And then another moment, you mentioned it's the fate of the ego.
nothing is really black and white, but the ego sees it as black and white. That's the problem. And because it sees it that way, it will produce a black and white outcome and a very rigid, fixated belief system and projections on the other, and will never be free of judgments, even if it says, I should be, and I should be. But the judgments are there pre-reflectively. Even before I think about what do I think about someone, I already have an opinion of that one, right? And so the ego, because it is unaware of its own subconscious fantasy projections, it is in a way always a step behind itself. And therefore, it cannot overcome that black and white thinking that's part of the inherent logos of the ego. But at the level of the soul, which is our real becoming, right? The sutratma, that's the true becoming that stays constant even from one lifetime to the next. The ego can only see this particular life, which is a much smaller sliver of reality than what the soul is able to be aware of. In that, there is a much more multi-leveled understanding of reality with all kinds of vague intermediary positions between black and white and every other possible color of the rainbow and every other possible shade of ethical status, let's say, and of meaning, moreness of an event, so that one can never pigeonhole whether what happened was a good thing or a bad thing, and it always turns out it was perfect and couldn't have happened any other way. But that level of vision is the soul's capacity to see, and the ego doesn't have that yet, even though it wants to, but it would have to sacrifice its egoic identity to have it. Okay? All right, thank you for a very good question, very important.
A comment from Dahlia, who says that she wanted to thank you for reminding us that the ego is already falling apart and not to worry. She said that it gave her a great sense of joy and relieved her of a sense of pressure that she currently feels to let go of the ego.
Thank you, Dahlia. I'm glad to hear it. Look forward to your return. Oh, yep. Okay.
Hi. As you're speaking tonight about there not being true reason until the fourth and the fifth assemblage points, it actually reminded me of the satsang last Saturday night where you're talking about, I think it's kanchukas.
Yes.
Would you say that they represent the first illogics at the level of duality?
Yeah.
Okay.
They are really the content of those three malas we always talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
So I don't really understand this idea of the kanchukas. I mean, I've read it a little bit, but what you said last week was they're the defenses against the power of the other. And I'm not sure if I wrote that down incorrectly or if you can explain a little bit more about the role that these play.
Well, by that what I mean is the real, because the kanchukas are a loss of reality, because a loss of wholeness. And so what is projected into the big other, whether it's God or the Buddha nature or whatever, as something separate from who I am and that I have to somehow reach, that differential is created by the kanchukas, which are simply limited belief systems that result in a kind of reality tunnel or tunnel vision of who I am that then prevents the full self-possession of all of the competencies of the soul that do not fit into the ego.
Would you say they're more of like a detailed map of black and white thinking? It gives you like five kind of clear examples of how black and white thinking is operating?
Yeah, it is, but it's not just black and white thinking. It's limitations of various kinds, like the belief that my mind is only able to reach as far as my voice can reach people, and doesn't recognize that the vibrations of consciousness extend throughout the morphogenic field of the planet. It can't see that and feel that, and it limits the transmission power of its own energy field because of that belief. So that kind of limitation, as well as the simple black and white or duality paradigm of two-valued logic. Okay.
Thank you. That's mm-hmm. very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Kalyan.
What captured my attention in tonight's teaching was the question of how does God, I think you said, show himself.
Mm.
And, well, I just found it a very interesting question to think about. Well, you mentioned in Christianity how it's shown, and then in Islam, and then I started going through my mind, well, how is it in Judaism? And one can get lost in this very superficial way of how does God show himself, even though it's a beautiful question. But what I appreciated how you took it further in the reading of the polishing the mirror, because you can just look in the mirror and see mm-hmm. God.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not enough. And then it was mentioned, don't get lost in that mirror. Just put the mirror down and look in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share. I thought it was very mm-hmm. beautiful. It touched me, and it also reminds me of, you know, stop believing what you see, and use, instead of these two eyes, use the third eye, because that's really where the truth of vision mm-hmm. is. And what, mm-hmm. yeah. So mm-hmm. it just kind of brought those things together, and uh-huh. I just thought it was very beautiful. Mm. It started out as a beautiful question, and then turned more into a insight mm-hmm. in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. For the Jewish persuasion, you of course have the myth of the Torah that God showed himself very directly, but only to Moshe, not to the others. They couldn't go up to Mount Sinai. He had to come down with the tablets and explain what he saw at the burning tree of life, etc. But of course, the Exodus itself and the opening of the Red Sea, what more do you need, to recognize there's a miraculous agency who is enabling this escape from the slavery of Egypt? So, but that's a myth, and nowadays very few Jews, I think, can accept that, at least at a level of face value, for good reason and good historical understanding now that is based on archaeological discoveries, etc. But the myth contains an eternal truth. It is a metaphor of a reality that all of us have to live through. We have to go through our own exodus, and we have to have faith that we will climb our own internal Mount Sinai, the mountain of God, in our consciousness, and we will see that eternal light, and we ourselves will become that tree of life that's on fire with the bliss of God consciousness. And that, in a way, is the mitzvah. That's what we must do if we fulfill the commandment of thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, all thy soul, all thy might. It will turn you into a burning tree of life. So you will fulfill that vision and know that God is real, and others will know by their seeing you. And that's what we are here to accomplish.
Thank you. I also was thinking about how you mentioned how in Islam it's through remembrance, not so much maybe a figure, but through remembrance. And mm-hmm. I feel that's very, very true also in Judaism. It's thick with commandments and the mitzvot and the halachot and all the laws and what you should wear, the kippah, like everything is about remembrance. And I don't know, it almost makes me feel like it's a religion designed for the ego because it just can't remember. It constantly needs reminders. It constantly needs guidance, and there's a lot of opportunity for that. And I don't know if other religions are also designed in that way.
All organized religions have the same. They all, okay. The priests have their uniform, the mullahs have theirs, and they've all got their own hats and caps and their own various symbolic attire that brings about at least the insignia of remembrance. It doesn't mean that will actually trigger a real remembrance, right? Or which is actually a recognition of the presence of God now, not just a remembrance, that Christ died on the cross for our sins, or Muhammad went on the Mi'raj so we would know the seventh heaven. And it's not about the remembrance of the past. It's the remembrance of who am I now that all religions are really trying to trigger. But the ego lives in the past and lives in the signifiers of identity. And yes, it'll remember, am I wearing my proper garments for my function? But it won't remember that its chosenness for that function is based and is validated only by its recognition of the presence of God now, that must be carried as if one is a temple of God's presence, so that light shines through one in every moment. And only then are we fulfilling the commandments, whether one is a Buddhist or a Taoist or Hindu or a Judeo-Christian, it's all the same.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Kalyan. Lakshmi.
Namaste, Shunya, and thank you for this teaching. I was mostly impacted on this idea of certitude, right? Of just this need that the ego has to understand, to feel okay. I recently went through an episode of having a need for certitude of a certain logic to understand a situation. And it was a big challenge, right, to overcome that need for certitude. And I'm linking it to a very interesting email that I received this afternoon that was positing that in Sat Yoga, we have to learn to live in paradox and ambiguity. And I love that word. I wanted to ask you if you could speak more about this this need to leave certitude and just accept what's coming in all trust and faith. I think that faith is very important, and also the difference between, if there is one, a paradox and ambiguity, and how does one learn, how does one accept, how does one embrace ambiguity and paradox as yogis and as sat yogis, this being a paradoxram for starters, right?
Indeed.
So if you could speak to that.
Okay, well, a very, very profound point that I wish I had time to meditate for a few hours before having to answer, but I'll wing it. In a way, ambiguity, I think, refers to the capacity for having our minds in quantum superposition so that we can recognize, I am not who I think I am. I know that, but I don't know who I am or who I could be. But I know that my potential and to manifest far more than my ego in its current condition allows to be fully expressed, because of its attachment to certitude at particular levels, which amount to addiction to fixation, right? And to a rigid grasp of reality as if it was made out of rules rather than out of freedom, right? And so ambiguity is a kind of a freeing of oneself from the need to be identical between one's virtual nature and one's actual nature, and to recognize that there is room to shift using the virtual to change the actual, right? And then even beyond the virtual, there is the potential of that capacity to even change the virtual level so that an entirely different kind of panorama reveals itself to the consciousness that can see with a far deeper vision than the ego has. And so that always leads, as soon as you know that you are capable of perceiving things differently than you do at any moment, even only if only in the sense of having many ego fragments within you that may see the same thing as good or bad or yes or no because of their conflicting drives and intentions, but also from a higher level that one can see the perfection within imperfection, and one can see how even that which looks like it is aversive to the development of what is your intention of bringing about harmony, let's say, and all of the higher values of communal living as a paradoxron, but to recognize that because paradox is always involved, there is a need to be able to accept the unacceptable in order to overcome one's own criteria of what should be, that is actually what is holding back the ability for it to become what it could be, right? And so it's only when one recognizes that one is one's own obstacle and one's own opportunity for freedom from oneself and one's own identification that one gains a kind of certitude that can allow total ambiguity and freedom of process on this plane, because one is not attached to any way that the world looks at any given moment, because you are aware that the trajectory is always going to be ultimately benevolent. Okay? And there is a way in which, because at the end of this cycle of time, every ego is in a state of what we could call post-traumatic subjectivity. Everyone has been traumatized and multiply traumatized, whether this was due to actual parental or family system abuse or that kind of thing, or simply because of the nature of the decomposing social order and the loss of culture and values and all of the meaningful pathways of spiritual development that used to be open that have been closed by the collective cynicism and nihilism of the Weltanschauung, if you will. So the consciousness in that state must recognize that as a result of trauma, it has not only been cut off from its own roots, because that's what a trauma is, right? It's a cut. But its own pranic energy field has often been inverted into a kind of anti-prana, so that the body produces symptoms of suffering, not health. And the prana produces a depletion of energy rather than an increase of energy. And this creates all kinds of symptoms that are current now and cannot be treated by allopathic medicine, which doesn't recognize the whole pranic energy body, let alone the fact that it can be magnetically inverted to become anti-life rather than pro-life, right? And so that post-traumatic subjectivity that is in a way subject to and continuing to produce negative pranic transmissions because of its own death drive, right, its lower death drive, creates a situation in which there is a constant motivation for feeling hopeless and despair and a kind of unfairness of the world and a sense of chaos in the context of life itself that cannot find an order or a meaning or a treatment even of something that should not be, should not exist, is not really part of the image of God or even its reflection in any anything like an authentic a way of a body appearing in a world as an instrument of divine beauty, let's say. So in this state where then the consciousness becomes involuted into a kind of a self-hatred that is inherent to it, which continues that snowball effect of negativity, once one is aware that this kind of a process is underway, that is an overwhelming force that one's consciousness cannot master because it's much too great. The only way that one can deal with that is to surrender to a power higher than that energy field that exists within the phenomenal plane. That's the only hope to escape from the energies of death that have been resulted from those traumatic cuts with the roots of our being. And that will require then a rising of our kundalini beyond the body and all of its sufferings into that level of consciousness in which one has transformed death into eternal life and presence and consciousness again. But through a need to escape from the kind of selfhood that has become a tomb of energies that want not to exist, all right? And so the human suffers from a failure to be, a failure to be able to live as an experiencer and a transmitter of life into the world, but instead has become a manifestation of death itself. And it's only by recognizing that its only pathway out is to become the death of death through that absolute life that is its own being, is, I think, the real meaning of the crucifixion that Christians are celebrating, and that death for our sins, for our having fallen under the reign of the death drive, that now forces us through the death of God and godliness from our consciousness. To be able to use the power of death itself in a form of self-overcoming in which we return to that unborn nature that was never touched by the kind of energy field that has been produced through our karma as a way of forcing us to reawaken to our true nature, because we would do it through no other way. Right? And then we will see everything as a blessing. Right? And so in a way, everyone who has that kind of post-traumatic disorder is, in fact, possessing the key to liberation and redemption. And without those traumatic residues, the motivation for liberation would not be there. And the capacity for compassion and unconditional love would not be able to return. And so it itself is the compost that will bring us back to our divine lotus throne of consciousness. Okay.
That was a very deep answer. Thank you so much. And the perhaps the clarification that remains, you said the only way is to surrender to a power that is greater than the power of the death drive, right?
Yeah.
Which is caused by the trauma,
yes,
that you were talking about.
Yes.
So I just wanted to clarify, this is the returning to a state of surrender and hopefully developing into adoration of that energy, of that higher power that is the only one that can redeem us from...
Yes, but because the postmodern ego does not have faith in that power, all it can do is to desire not to be, right? That's what its intention becomes, right? And this is what produces physical suicide as well, right? But suicide won't end that becoming. It will continue. And those who are at least awake to that will recognize that they must find a way not to be or to ever have been, right? To wipe out that trace of existence that will produce a bondage on the wheel of life and death to continue into whatever future the world has. But the only way out is to reach a level of consciousness that transcends the mind. The mind must be blotted out. And in that kind of nihilistic desire for complete elimination of consciousness, we will discover the fullness of a consciousness we did not imagine was real.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're out of time, but is there any last burning question before we adjourn? No? All right. Well, I hope this has been useful in some way for all of you, and blessings for your realization of that which can never be traumatized or defiled within you, and to remember and recognize the infinite beauty of your incorporeal self and the deathless nature of your being, and may you live in that state regardless of the decomposition of the phenomenal plane in these final days of the demise of a civilization that is terminally ill, and may you be manifestations of the eternal life that is the only hope and the ultimate majesty and redemption of our being that will come only through those who have gone all the way through the journey of consciousness to the other side of death itself, into eternal presence. Namaste.
Namaste.